The story of the indigenous woman who came to be known as Sally Kanash got twisted over the years. Sally was born around 1828 in what is now central Utah. It was Mexican territory in those days. She was from a band of Ute people called Pavant. It was said Sally was an Indian princess. She wasn't. It was said she was violently murdered. She wasn't. Some said her life had a happy ending. It didn't. And it's funny that people were making stuff up about Sally's life because the real story is honestly enough to be fantastic and hard to believe. The anthropologist Virginia Kearns tells it in a new book, which begins in 1847, the year the Mormon pioneers arrived in the Salt Lake Valley. It was winter. There wasn't much of a settlement yet. There was a fort, a few basic cabins. John Young, this was Brigham Young's nephew, lived in one of them, on a spot around what is now South Temple and State Street. Virginia Kearns says from a distance he heard shouts and piercing cries.
This was in December, and snow had fallen. And they heard some noise. They went to investigate, and they found that there was a young girl, a young Indian girl. She was wearing a bark skirt, and that was all. She had black hair, but had been hacked off, very short. She was very thin, and she had burns and cuts and then streaks of dried blood and ashes on her body. John had run to the fort to get some other people to come to see what was going on. And one of them was Charlie Decker, who was the brother of Clara, one of the plural wives of Brigham Young and the woman that Sally lived with for many years. And the Indian men who had Sally were demanding that they be given something for her. And Charlie stepped forward when the captors were threatening to kill her, and he offered his rifle for her. And that was accepted. They left, and Charlie had this young woman who he had given his rifle for. And so from that point, she did belong to him. Charlie took her to his sister, Clara, and Clara set about trying to teach her how to work.
You mention in the book that from the moment Charlie traded his rifle for her, she began a new life alone. She kept silent, you say. She kept watching. She kept waiting. What was this young woman thinking, if you can imagine?
I think she was thinking that she wanted to go home. And here the story gets complicated because many Indian women who were taken captive would immediately run away and they could find their way home. But she did not go back home. And later there's some evidence that there was an attempt at recapture. And I think she was very afraid of her captor. And it came to seem safer in that fort rather than on her own trying to walk 200 miles south to get home. But I think she never gave up her interest in having a home, and for years did not give up her interest in going home. And she did have the idea that her mother and sisters would come get her, and then she could go home with them. But that didn't happen. I think she gave up on going home to her place of origin when she probably learned that her family, they were gone. They had probably died. And I think it was at that point she probably gave up on the idea of going home and realized that she would be staying where she was.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Virginia Kearns says a good part of the story of this young woman faded over time. And the parts of it, she says, the Mormon settlers did remember revealed what they believed the story to be about. It was about how they found something wild and made it civilized. They didn't remember who the girl was or where she came from. They didn't remember she was traumatized or separated from her people. They didn't remember she was mostly seen as a servant and that she died sad and alone. Kearns says what they remembered was that they had saved Sally from certain death. They gave her food and shelter and a new home. This was the part of the story they told again and again. Kearns' book is called Sally in Three Worlds, and in it, she says a single life can illuminate an entire cultural and social world.
I think that Sally's life illuminates something important that happened in the American West in the late 1840s, and that also had happened repeatedly in human history, and that was when people who lived by farming and livestock production moved into wild lands, there were consequences for the native ecosystems that they moved into and also for the people living there. And so Sally's life stands to me as a window through which we can see that process, most specifically in what became Utah, but also more broadly in other places and in other times of human history. Once the so-called Neolithic Revolution or the revolution in food production, the beginning of plant and animal domestication began, because it changed everything.
This idea of wild versus civilized, this is a theme that comes up again and again in Sally's story and the way you talk about it in the book. And you say it to her tale is really illuminates how people have represented and treated what they regard as wild. Explain what you mean. Mm-hmm. How have they seen the wild and this idea of, again, taming it, I guess?
Not all human beings have thought about some things being wild and some things being tame. So that's a particular construct of people who do live by farming and livestock production, who have domesticated plants and animals. So people who lived as hunter-gatherers, in many cases, they had nothing equivalent to our concepts of wild or wilderness. If they did have those concepts later on after contact, it was as imported constructs. They were not original to them.
You mention how, unlike the hunter-gatherers who lived, as you say in the book, sustainably on wild land, settlers needed to get more and more land. You also talk about how settlers were settled, right? They were rooted, whereas indigenous people moved around more. And so this idea of owning land, of property, of place, was the distinctions there were really profound, it seems.
A profound distinctions, and these were two systems that were in conflict, because people who lived by hunting and gathering on wild lands watched as their lands were transformed by agriculture and by grazing livestock. So if they were able to move on, they might choose to do that, but it could be that other lands were occupied and they were not able to move on. But there are two systems that are quite different and are in conflict.
Yeah.
Two kinds of subsistence systems, and then that affects much else. And the settlers, the people of the plow and the cow, they have populations that increase over time so that they need more land, and they tend to move into areas where wild land, which to their reckoning may look like free land, you know, nobody holds title to it, they tend to expand. So civilization, which is the form, the political form associated with farming and livestock production, it's, I think, inherently expansionist, or it was at least in earlier times, and people kept moving and they kept displacing hunter-gatherers. So there was a time in human history when, of course, all of our ancestors lived as hunter-gatherers.
Yeah.
And starting with the Neolithic Revolution thousands of years ago, some populations took up another way of making a living and slowly spread out. And we've come to a point in the world where there are very few people left who can live by hunting and gathering, and where all of the world is claimed by various complex societies or civilizations. It happened rather quickly.
Yeah.
Some thousands of years.
What's your role? How do you see your role in telling this story? I mean, you're telling it as an anthropologist, and you mentioned early in the book that it's not your aim to, as you say, deprecate or to celebrate the settler colonist. You're trying to, what, just be an observer of it?
Well, it's a little complicated. You know, sometimes anthropologists talk about insider points of view and outsider points of view.
Yeah.
And not to say that one's correct and the other's wrong, but that there can be alternative points of view. So what I see here is that the Indians had one point of view about what was happening in the 19th century in what is now Utah, and the settlers had another point of view. And those points of view have persisted over time. They're not matching points of view. And then an anthropologist who's trying to make sense of them might conclude that in some respects they agree in certain ways, or an anthropologist as the outsider with the outsider point of view might have some insights, a different perspective. But I considered my role as giving voice to the various parties as best I could.
Yeah. In some ways, I felt like I wasn't sure how we should approach the story of Sally's captivity and her, you know, the sort of origin story of how she ends up among white settlers. Because there's so much myth associated with it. The story has been retold. It's been refabricated. It's like it's hard to tell. I mean, we'll get to, obviously, the story as you tell it. But it seems like it's such a story packed with inaccuracies and myths and misimpressions that it's hard to know where to start. Did you find that same problem?
Oh, yes, I did, because every time I thought that maybe I had a handle on it, I would find new claims about her, and I would have to stop and investigate. And much of it proved to be unreliable,
yeah.
But she was a kind of magnet for all sorts of claims, conflicting claims, and so that's an interesting thing about her. But I think it was because really, the narrative structure, that was what was driving the story. And in a sense, the details did not matter very much. Mm. What mattered was that she was a wild Indian, yeah. Or as it was sometimes put, a genuine savage, who was made civilized. And that was the important point in the story. So all of the details were possibly just details and didn't matter so much. But of course, I think those details are very telling and very important, and we can only understand her life if we can get into those details.
It's funny, there were a lot of these captivity narratives in that era. You tell about a few. One, the story of the woman named Cynthia Ann. Cynthia Ann Parker. Say something about that, about just what these particular stories said, because again, there's that narrative structure, the idea that Cynthia Ann, what's so interesting about Cynthia Ann is she chooses not to. She's a failure in the structure. She doesn't want to go back, right?
That's right. That's right. And there were other Cynthia Anns as well.
Yeah.
But Cynthia Ann's story is that her family, they were Virginians who moved into Illinois and then who moved on to what was then Mexican territory, now Texas. And they settled there, and there was a raid by Comanche Indians and some allies, and Cynthia and other members of the family, another young woman at least, they were taken, carried away as captives, and many family members were killed. And there's a very famous film by John Ford, directed by John Ford, The Searchers, which is based on that story, but it does a lot of fiddling around with the details. But it is true that Cynthia Ann's uncle spent years trying to find out where she had gone and whether the Comanche had her, where she was, because he wanted to ransom her and get her back. He finally had to give up after something like 6 or 7 years. And so then there were occasional sightings of Cynthia Ann, but when an army officer finally did find a Comanche group where they had Cynthia, and he talked to them about giving her up, she wept. She did not want to go back. And eventually, when the army, years later, went up against the Comanche, and it was really the beginning of the end for them, they did capture her and take her back home, only she did not consider that her home anymore. And she wanted to stay. She had become Comanche. She was a Comanche woman. She wanted to stay with her Comanche family. And there were other cases like that. It's by no means an isolated case. She had, I believe it was a cousin who was taken at the same time, who was somewhat older and who ended up being ransomed by a couple living in Santa Fe and then sent back to Texas. And she wrote basically a captivity narrative, and she thought it was terrible. What had happened was terrible. These savages, these wild people, had captured her. But Cynthia Ann was young. She was 8, and she adjusted, and she loved her family, and she loved that way of life.
Well, in the story of Sally, you have her family who takes her up, who read the Bible. They were Mormon, so they also had a Book of Mormon that had a particular – so the Bible has an idea. It doesn't say anything directly about Indians, but there is a sort of a Genesis story, and people come to certain opinions about wild versus civilized. And as you say, the Latter-day Saints themselves had the Book of Mormon. So what were they getting from their scripture, and what did that tell them about these native people?
Well, I think that they were getting a particular understanding of the past and of who the Indians of North America were from their scripture. And they, however, shared with many Americans of the time and other American settlers in the West who were not Mormon the idea that these wild people must be civilized, and that it was their duty to do that. And Americans had, in eastern places, had started doing that very early, going on civilizing missions and trying to change the way Indians lived to be more like the way Americans lived, American settlers. So it is a particular understanding that they had of Indians who were living in what is now Utah. But in a general sense, it's not so different from the way other Americans were thinking about who Indians are and what must be done with them. There was a very common idea that Indians had somehow degenerated from some higher state, you know, so they must be lifted up again.
Virginia Kearns, she's a writer and professor emerita of anthropology at the College of William and Mary. Her new book is Sally in Three Worlds, An Indian Captive in the House of Brigham Young. We'll take a break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
KUER keeps you connected to Utah, both on the air and online. You'll find KUER on all of your favorite social media platforms. Like us on Facebook, we're at KUER 90.1. Check out our Instagram, we're at KUER 901. And follow us on Twitter, we're simply at KUER. We hope to see you on social media and on our website, KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the remarkable life of Sally Kanosh. That was the name she was given by Mormon settlers after slave traders gave her up in exchange for a rifle. She was a young indigenous woman captured from her band of Ute people called Pavant in the central Utah Territory and taken in by the sprawling family of Brigham Young. In a new book, the anthropologist Virginia Kearns is trying to make this woman something more than what she's become, a character in this master narrative structure about something wild becoming civilized. Kearns' book is Sally in Three Worlds. I wanted to go through Sally's story standing as an example of this, you know, narrative structure. A young Native woman claimed and named. That's where we are now in the story. Talk about the name that she gets. Talk about language at this point, too. What does she – she doesn't understand them. Take us to this point in the story, if you would. She's claimed, as you say, and named.
So she was given a name. She was called Sally. And I don't imagine that she would necessarily have objected to that name because it wasn't so uncommon to have several different names. So that became her English name. And I was interested to see how at the same time that she was being given that name, settlers were also naming many of the places in Salt Lake Valley and beyond and giving them usually English names because really naming was part of claiming. And occasionally they would keep an Indian name, but for the most part they were putting English names onto the landscape. So Sally also got her English name.
One of the things you mention is how Sally, as she comes to now start to understand bits of the English language, she figures at some point she'll be able to know enough to be able to say, this is what happened. My mother and sisters are out there. Maybe they're looking for me. I want to go home. Why didn't that ever happen? Was she ever able to convey those circumstances? Was she even listened to if she did? Do we know?
She did say something about her circumstances to Eliza Snow, who recorded years later what she recalled Sally saying. And that was Sally told her, first of all, that she was Pavant Ute. She told her that her name was Eliza recorded it as Pidash. I don't know whether that was a good English rendering of the name, but that was how Eliza recorded it. She said that her father had died and that her mother had remarried and her cruel stepfather had sold her.
Do you think in those early days, you mentioned she was afraid of leaving, but one of the things you say is that she could have gone off and made her way. As you say, she knew about the plants there. She knew the kinds of places to find the best food. And what it reveals in this part of the book is something really important, I think, to say I wanted you to talk about, and that is just how fertile this place was for the indigenous people who made it their home. It was packed with food and berries and nuts that they understood. Even though the white settlers who came here portrayed it as barren and infertile. But talk a little bit about that, just how – because I thought that was such an interesting contrast in those two perceptions.
Well, there was enough food and the Indians were knowledgeable people, great botanists really. They knew all about the plants and used them for food and used them for – dyes for making tools, for constructing their shelters, for all sorts of things. So to them, what they saw was a landscape of sustenance. Their needs were met, and they had the knowledge to be able to use those things to meet their needs. When the first settlers arrived in Salt Lake Valley, some of them at least thought it looked like a very fertile place. Not all of them, but some of them did. They saw high green grass. They saw herds of mountain goats on the flanks of mountains. They saw other animals. They saw water rushing down from creeks in the mountains. So they saw it as a very fertile place. And the fur trappers who preceded them, Jedediah Smith called it his home in the wilderness. He loved the Salt Lake Valley. So some people, and another fur trapper, Osborne Russell, in the same way, saw it as a very fertile, green and fertile place. They, of course, weren't necessarily looking for plant foods, but Indians did, and Indian women in particular knew a lot about those plant foods. So it was a a place of sustenance for them. As more and more settlers came in, I think that the look of Salt Lake Valley changed. The horses ate those green grasses. The water was being diverted. The animals were being hunted out. It turned into another kind of place. But it's interesting, Doug, that even some of the early people, Wilford Woodruff comes to mind. He was one of the first settlers. Years later, recalled it as a very bleak place, just filled with black crickets and not much else. Mm. So a story had developed about settlement, and it was a story in which the settlers arrived in an empty place, an empty barren place, and then made it blossom like the rose.
You mention how wild animals were seen as an affliction for the white settlers who arrived, you know, for their domestic animals, livestock. So what they did is they started decimating the populations of wild creatures, which really threw off the balance. I mean, there were contests. It just the number, you even mentioned they enumerated the number during one particular moment, a kind of a contest to see how many animals they could kill. And I'm just wondering what people like Sally or the indigenous people here made of something like that.
I think it must have been very puzzling at best, because they weren't taking those animals to eat or to necessarily take the pelts and sell into the fur trade. They were simply killing animals that they saw as posing risk to their farm fields and to their domesticated animals. So I think it must have been a very puzzling event. And in one of the organized winter hunts that took place, I think in the second winter after the settlers arrived, 3,900 wild animals, from bears to hawks, were killed. And it's an incredible number, since that came primarily from Salt Lake Valley and maybe from the canyons, maybe. But they killed, and it did not include game animals that they were killing, for example, deer. And those were animals also that the Indians who lived in the valley had, of course, depended on for food. But with so many thousands of people suddenly there from another place, the deer disappeared. And then the other animals that were seen as posing a threat were taken out as well. It was a complete assault on the native ecosystem.
So we've talked about, in this structure that you lay out in the book, a young woman claimed and named, and then tamed or transformed or attempted to anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about the fact, this attempt at taming her and her coming to accept it, which is another part of it, accepting the new life. And it gets us to this story you tell. It's a remarkable story of a woman named Zina mm-hmm. Young, who is a healer, and this story of speaking in tongues, because it seems like a really transformational moment for Sally. Take us through the story.
Yes. So when Clara was about 6 months pregnant with her first child, Zina came to see her one evening and to bless her. And when she was finished, she turned to Sally and she began to speak in tongues, as was not uncommon at that time. Women would have meetings where they prayed and spoke in tongues. And so she began speaking in tongues. And when she was finished, Clara did not understand what she had said, and another young woman who was present did not understand what she had said. But Sally said she had understood. Yeah. She had understood that strange language. And what she understood Zina to say was that her mother and sisters were coming for her, and that she should wait for them. And so that marked a turning point for her in terms of her willingness to do as she was being instructed, to do work that she had been resisting, apparently, for quite a long time.
And the message that Sally thought she was getting was mm-hmm. to, for now, Mm-hmm. Be a good girl, as you say.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. It was a relief to hear this because she apparently had been living in some despair for a year and a half, thinking that she was trapped. And again, there's a question about why didn't she leave? It is an interesting question. I think she hadn't tried to leave because I think she was very fearful of being recaptured, possibly by the same captor. But this was good news because if her mother and sisters came, presumably she thought she would be safer if she left with them.
Yeah. One of the things you write about is how Sally came to accept Mormon religious ideas and doctrines because, as you put it, it offered her protections from her captor and this powerful sorcery she believed, which gets us to this idea of the trauma that she must have kept with her, right? Don't you think?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. We could never know exactly what happened on her trip north, but the very fact that she was ripped away from her home and her family and taken north to a place where she had never been. She knew the direction she was going, but and then left among strangers who didn't speak her language, who looked very odd to her and lived in a strange way. It was all very, very traumatic. And she was deeply afraid of her captor, I believe.
Yeah. You say the Mormon doctrine also offered her the promise of a reunion with her family of birth. Not now, obviously, but after death, I guess.
Yes, it did. And later in life, she did take part in some rituals that were designed to give her family the possibility to be baptized as Mormons, and that she, you know, so she would see them again in a good place after death.
Virginia Kearns, her new book is Sally in Three Worlds, an Indian captive in the house of Brigham Young. We'll take another break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Listener support makes programming possible on KUER. You can easily manage your donation anytime with MyKUER. It's a place to go to update your contact information, find tax receipts, change the amount of your donation, or switch payment methods. For example, you can update that expired credit card with a direct donation from your bank account. Sign into your personal online donor profile at KUER.org/MyKUER.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the anthropologist Virginia Kearns is taking us through her new book, Sally in Three Worlds. It's about the Pahvant Ute woman who came to be known as Sally Kanosh, an Indian captive in the house of Brigham Young. How did Sally fit in the Young household? She learned fluent English. She came to be the chief cook in the Young household. You mention in the book how at the end of the day she would join the family in the parlor. They would sing and they would pray and they would listen to stories. But was she thought of as a family member or was she thought of as a servant? I mean, where did she fit?
Well, census takers were told that she was a servant. So I think that it's safe to say that most of the people living in the Lion House did think of her as a servant. But Sally, I believe, thought of herself as a family member. And unlike other women who worked in the kitchen and who were mostly immigrants and they stayed for a little while and they learned English and they married and they moved on, Sally stayed for a long time. Unlike the other people in the kitchen, she didn't live in servants' quarters. She lived with Clara and the children in a suite. So she seemed to be part of a family group. And I think that at a certain point when Sally decided she was staying, that she couldn't go home, she had silently adopted Clara and the children as her family in a way that Indians commonly adopted people that they took captive. If they kept them, if they remained with them, they were often adopted and integrated into the group. So that would have been Sally's understanding, I believe, of what was possible for her. So I think that she adopted them, but I don't think that they adopted her.
Let's talk about another sort of transformational moment in her life. This comes when a man named Kanash goes into the kitchen. Tell us what happens.
Well, by that time, Sally worked at the Lion House in the kitchen there for many years, for 15 years, 17 years. And she later moved to the kitchen of the Beehive House where he lived, and his office was there, and one of his wives presided over the kitchen. And Sally and that wife and a staff of workers were involved every day in preparing meals for workmen who worked on the estate. So she wasn't cooking for the family anymore, and I think she wasn't too happy about that. But it was close to the office where Kanash visited Brigham Young, and so he was able to see her. She was not interested in seeing him. By then, she was totally immersed in the settler world and was not interested.
He's a Pavant leader, though, and he was attracted to her. He was taken by her.
It's hard to say, Doug. It's hard to say when he developed an interest in visiting Sally and spending time with her. I think it was at the Beehive House. That was later. I think it was of great interest to him that a member of his community or a former member of his community lived in the house of Brigham Young and was so close to the presence of that very powerful man. I think he became interested in marrying her after several of his wives died, and I think he saw advantage in marrying a woman who spoke fluent English, who understood the settlers' ways, and who could possibly do a lot to help his people get along with settlers because they liked it when they saw an Indian woman who had been so highly assimilated.
Mm-hmm.
And they saw it as promising, you know, well, maybe these other Indians will also assimilate.
Yeah. Sally did not want to marry Chief Kanash. She didn't want to leave the family.
No.
She thought of these people as her family.
Yes.
So basically what happens is an arranged marriage. Brigham Young insists. He basically gives Sally to Kanash. Here's how you put it in the book. Giving Sally to Chief Kanash would help Brigham Young repay him for many favors and years as a helpful ally. And as you say, it cost virtually nothing financially or politically.
That's right. So it was a very easy thing for him to do. Also, by that point, many of his wives who had lived in the Lion House and had young children there had moved on. He had bought houses for them and deeded them to the wives so that at his death they would have something. They would have some property. It would be something that would help them. And many of the children had grown up. So there were a diminishing number of people at the Lion House, and there were lots of immigrant women who could help Lucy, the wife who oversaw the kitchen at the Beehive House. So there was really, and also Brigham Young was in the process of building a new house. He wasn't even going to stay at the Beehive House. So I think it seemed to him like a good point at which to have Sally go somewhere else, do something useful, because she wasn't of such great use anymore. In the kitchen. She could be replaced, and he could do a favor to Kanash.
The wedding is really interesting. She, as you say in the book, she didn't consent to a ceremony that would mean that she would spend life after death with Kanash.
That's right.
And it gets us to this portrait that you first saw of her sitting alone. She didn't want to sit for a wedding portrait with Kanash. And so her sitting there in that portrait is this – you say the photograph is a fitting expression of her life as an Indian captive caught in civilization. So people mm-hmm. get a chance to see, and you must see this photo. This is just after she's married. And this mm-hmm. sense of, I don't know, I want to say defiance, courage. I don't know. Mm-hmm. It's pretty amazing to me.
Mm-hmm. I agree. And it was common at that time for husband and wife to have a portrait taken together, but hers was taken alone. And I think that, you know, she had not been interested in having a wedding that would seal her to Kanash and mean that they would be together eternally. She was not interested. She did not want to get married. She did not want to leave. I think it came as a complete devastating shock to her.
Brigham Young gave her a mission. Mm-hmm. The idea was marry Kanash and go with him back to the Pavant people and mm-hmm. civilize them. Was that the mm-hmm. mission? That was the mandate that he gave her?
That was the mandate that he gave her, exactly. And of course she didn't want to leave. She didn't want to marry Kanash. She didn't want to go there. And she didn't want to be involved in that. I think it's also very striking that there's no evidence that anybody stepped forward to try to help her, to try to, for example, find her another place to live in Salt Lake City, another family to work for, something like that. Nobody was willing to go up against Brigham Young because he was a very powerful man and he had spoken. He had made that decision. And one of his daughters has said that, you know, she thought that he thought it was the best for everyone concerned, but it wasn't the best for Sally.
So she consents. She goes. She doesn't want to. What was life like in, as you described it, in the village? Talk about where she ends up going.
Well, she managed to have the bishop convinced to let her live with Chief Kanash in the village for a year while another house was being built for them in the settlement where Chief Kanash and his people lived. So she and Chief Kanash moved into an empty log structure and lived there for a year. And it gave her the chance to try to reconstruct, in a way, her earlier life.
Yeah.
She helped other women with their young children. She cooked and invited children to stop after school to sample sweets she had made, and she associated with settlers who they had become a community she was more comfortable being with. And she had taken on, I think, Doug, many of the practices and the values of the settlers.
Yeah.
And so she looked down on her community of origin.
This was such a sad part of the story, I think, how her life had changed. I mean, you talk about how since she took to wearing fine clothing to mastering, you know, the so-called civilized arts of cooking and housekeeping in these white mm-hmm. settler households. She mm-hmm. no longer did laundry for other women. She didn't gather native foods from the mm-hmm. wild. She didn't go on hunting trips. Mm-hmm. She didn't ride horses. She stayed at home and she kept house, you know. Mm-hmm. And so how far apart was she, I guess, from her life as an indigenous person? And what is there to say about that? I guess it could be seen as a kind of a tragedy that she was thoroughly transformed by white culture, but this was her life. I mean, how do you see that?
I see it as especially tragic in that she no longer had the community of people she had grown up with,
yeah.
and her culture of origin, although there were many things about her that reflected her native heritage. So she had taken on these other things, but in many ways she also was fundamentally Indian because you can't, at the age of 19, just erase everything and start over.
Yeah.
Even if you learn a lot about your new cultural setting, you can't get rid of it. So there was a lot still there, but she had come to have a real prejudice against that community. And at the same time, she was not fully accepted by the settler community. They continued to see her as a curiosity, as an Indian, once wild, a genuine savage who had learned to be civilized. But someone later described her as possibly the loneliest person they had ever met. And I think That was true. There was nobody else like her, and she didn't really fit in fully in either world.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned she knew as she was there in that cabin, passing these empty hours, as you described them, in this blank silence mm-hmm. and darkness, that she wasn't going to be able to return to the city. She wasn't going to be able to get back mm-hmm. to the Lion House. She wasn't going to see Clara and her family again. Mm-hmm. And this is how you put it in the book. You say she belonged nowhere.
I think that's true, unfortunately. And this was someone who had bent her efforts to having a home, to recovering her home or to making a new home and to having a family, an adopted family. And so it was a terrible thing to happen. And also that Clara never answered her letters, I think,
yeah.
was just quite a blow.
Do you think it could be said on some level, imprecise as it may be, that she died of heartbreak? She didn't last very long there. She dies in December. She gets sick. 4 days later, she dies. She seems like she's just given up.
I think so. And I don't know what people at that time thought. There was nothing said in the published obituary about her cause of death, but later, people in the village who had known her did talk about why she might have died, and some said she died from loneliness, some said she died from heartbreak, some said she couldn't bear the rigors, the physical rigors of life when she returned to live with Chief Kanash and his people. There is actually research now about the effects of social isolation on health, and they're not good.
You tell the story before she dies, there, her lonely life in the village, when she goes to a Relief Society meeting, mm-hmm. where a song there was sung, a song, "Do They Miss Me at Home?" Would you tell that story?
Yes. So when she was able to move into the village and she tried to set about creating a life for herself there, she began going to Relief Society meetings, and at one of the meetings, two women sang a song that had been very popular during the Civil War. It was a poem by a young woman that was set to music in the 1850s, and then during the Civil War, it became very popular. Do They Miss Me at Home? Do They Miss Me? It's a very sentimental song, mm-hmm. and as the story went, Sally listened to it, and at the end of it said, "I wonder," and was very tearful, and I don't doubt that that happened. I wonder whether she actually said, "I wonder," with tears in her eyes. It wasn't her way, really, to show her emotions. Mm. Again, she had an emotional style that reflected the way she grew up more than the settlers' world that she joined.
Mm. Why is this an important story for people to hear?
Well, because I think Sally's life is a window on a very important time in the American West when settlers were pouring in, Indians were being affected in quite devastating ways, many died. Sally, remarkably, survived a measles epidemic when, you know, many Indian people died from measles and from the other epidemic diseases. She actually survived it. So her life really stands as an example of some of the devastation that was wrought on lives by the turn that was taken when settlers came into areas of the American West and Indians were dispossessed of their homeland and could no longer get food and live in the ways that they had previously. And Sally's life was disrupted and changed in a fairly unusual way. And we really only know about it because she lived with a very famous family. For that reason, some things were said about her, some things were recorded. But she's the quintessential marginalized, silent woman, an indigenous woman, who never learned to read or write. She could not record her own life story. And no one thought she was important enough to record it for her. She stands for a lot of people who whose lives were transformed by transformations to wild lands and to the beings, all the sentient beings who lived on those wild lands.
Virginia Kearns, thank you very much.
Thank you, Doug.
It's Virginia Kearns. She's a writer and professor emerita of anthropology at the College of William and Mary. Her book is Sally in Three Worlds, An Indian Captive in the House of Brigham Young. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter at Radio West. Our intern is Stu Nolan, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard, Tim Slover, and Carrie Watson. I'm Doug Fabrizio.